I knew that probably was never going to be the ultimate aim, to just run digital programs within a hospital organization. So I did an exec MBA, Oxford, at the same time, which was, I think, again, one of those life moments that really does definitely open your mind. Not so much the content of the MBA, but the people, of course. This is what they say, it's the people, you know, suddenly having been in quite a echo chamber of healthcare, you know, like everyone that I knew was a doctor and everyone that I knew worked in a hospital. And suddenly then to be exposed to a bunch of people who are from across the world, from across industries, from across like perspectives of life. And so I think that was pretty important to open up my mind to what could be done in the world, and then, you know, see if we could apply that to healthcare.
Welcome to today's episode. We're going to dive right into a captivating conversation with Dr. Nicholas De Pennington. He's a pioneering voice in healthcare innovation and the founder of Euphonia, a health tech company changing the way patient care is delivered. Now, Nick shares a fascinating journey from his early ambitions in neurosurgery to the difficult realization at the end of his training that the traditional clinical path wasn't enough to satisfy his drive to innovate in healthcare. In this episode, we explore his path to building a company leveraging AI and voice-based technology to transform routine patient consultations. And he speaks candidly about the challenges he faced bringing innovation into established systems like the UK's NHS, where he had to overcome not only technical obstacles, but also organizational resistance. Nick discusses the contrasting coverage between healthcare in the UK and the US, shedding light on the differences in how to scale innovation across diverse healthcare landscapes. And throughout, Dr. De Pennington offers powerful insights on the future of healthcare, where he sees AI not as a replacement, but as a tool to empower clinicians and focus on what matters most. This is a thought-provoking episode for anyone curious about the intersection of healthcare and technology and the potential for patient-centered design, the future role of AI medicine, and how doctors frustrated with status quo might find a different path as entrepreneurs.
So yeah, born, grew up there, but then went to university down in Cambridge originally, moved across to Oxford, the great rival, for my clinical training, and then have stayed roughly in that area ever since. So I lived just outside Oxford and worked in Oxford, London for probably the best part of 25 years now. UK training, so if you know what that entails, is a slightly protracted period of generalist training in surgery, rotating through a different surgical specialties, sort of 6 months in each. But I always knew, actually, ever since I was at the start of med school, that actually what I wanted to do was neurosurgery. When I was a medical student, I did almost like internships in neurosurgery, just trying to get as embedded as possible. And yeah, I moved pretty quickly into neurosurgery training. So I went into a neurosurgery residency program. And again, UK, that kind of training is a bit more protracted than it, quite frankly, needs to be. But yeah, I went all the way through to the very end, all of the kind of examinations, all of the boxes ticked, fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, and then decided I ought to do something slightly different with my life. I enjoyed neurosurgery. I thought it's, you know, lived up to what I expected in terms of its interest level to start with. But then I guess I probably, and this is only on reflection, it definitely wasn't something that I realized at the time, but on reflection, I think I was actually getting bored. I was never a fan of kind of just doing the same thing. And almost, I didn't realize at the time, but now do, is I think it was a case of doing the same thing and not getting a different outcome, not improving. Like what we did was the thing that was frustrating to me. Again, in retrospect, I think overall there was a bit of a carrot and a stick, I think. So the stick was that sort of frustration with the idea that I could spend the next 30 years of my life pretty much doing the same thing that I saw my kind of senior colleagues had been doing for the previous 30 years of their lives. And that would be a waste of life, but also be frustrating because at the same time, I was trying to push and do innovation things. I got a 3D printer into the department before. That was something that was common. I set up a platform to manage referrals of patients across the region, a digital platform for that. Again, when people were doing things on bits of paper. But each time I did that, I felt like I was like fighting an uphill battle against the kind of incumbency. And so I realized that probably that's the stuff that really gave me energy. That's the stuff that excited me. I thought that's the stuff that kind of had the ability to make change. And I probably could have done it as well as being a neurosurgeon, but I got to the point of realizing that I would probably not have been a very happy person because I would have really been banging my head against a brick wall, trying to do that as well as the sort of steady state of clinical practice, at least as it was configured, and I saw it in the UK.
Now, I think this is really important, and there are two parts here. The first is the simple and important life lesson that you have to be true to yourself. Sometimes things, once achieved, are not all that you expected. And with all due respect to all my surgical friends, few would disagree that neurosurgery is the hardest achievement in the field, and yet, sometimes you simply have to walk away. I trained in orthopedic oncology, but it was not until I actually finished my training that I realized that I was not really cut out for that job. As intellectually stimulating as the work was, it was incredibly difficult because 60% of patients would not survive beyond 5 years of treatment, and almost all of them were younger adults, age 16 or less. And so, massive respect to my oncology colleagues, it just wasn't for me. And the second point is to be open to chance encounters. Careers are seldom linear, and we will hear next about how Nick became an entrepreneur.
I was on a mission to be like the fastest into the neurosurgery program, and I pretty much was, and to move through everything and tick the boxes. Most doctors and particularly surgeons and maybe even neurosurgeons are sort of like trying to overachieve all the time. And then for this bit, actually, I wasn't doing that. And again, I don't think I recognized it at the time, but in retrospect, it was because I didn't want to keep going on that path. And so then I was exploring what else to do with my life. I flirted with some discussions with some friends that I knew from back in university who are then partners in, you know, the big consulting firms is that the kind of pivot out, which is a well-trodden path for quite a lot of medics, but felt that probably that was probably another form of life frustration, although better compensated than being a medic in the UK, at least. But what ended up happening is I'd done these innovation pieces of work in the hospital in Oxford, and along with a couple of colleagues, decided that this was such a frustrating and challenging experience that we needed to do something to make it less frustrating and challenging for other people and to be able to enact change across the healthcare system. So we set up an organization that's essentially an innovation program for the hospital. And this is very bootstrapped. We pulled together a small community of people who are interested and then progressively managed to get bits of resourcing. We got a European Union grant when the UK was still in the European Union to support that. We got some support from the local sort of authority from the hospital eventually, because we got them bought into the idea that if they didn't embrace innovation, they were going to be falling behind. And so did that. And then as I've come to the end of my training, actually one of the senior members of the hospital board was good enough to pick on the fact that I'd done that relatively successfully and gave me a role basically running that somewhat more formally in the hospital. So I transitioned into basically a management role in the hospital and ended up running a few programs, running a few digital deployments, pushing forward some of the work that we were doing. So we were a Cerner site. There was a bit of funding coming in the UK government for kind of pushing digitization. So actually I ended up running the program where we deployed Cerner's Ignite APIs, the FHIR APIs. So we were the first place outside of the US to go live with that. We deployed a patient portal, and then we started working on trying to deploy population health at scale. So there was a program try and connect up the health and care records from people across about a 4 million person region southeast of England. And this was mirrored elsewhere in the country, but trying to connect together their hospital records, their primary care records, their social care records, these are all highly disparate siloed systems, and they still remain. And that was a really challenging project.
Determined to make impactful improvements, Nick uses clinical experience to innovate within the hospital. He introduced digital tools such as 3D printers and digital patient referral platforms to enhance workflows. Then he had a chance to build an innovation hub within the hospital and launch an electronic health record, which in itself is pretty challenging. And in so doing, he now has accrued an entirely different skill set, which is quite complementary to that of a surgeon. He learned how to fundraise, manage teams, lead innovation, and leverage the local needs of the hospital to achieve his own goals of driving innovation. And this will be critical to his success as an entrepreneur in healthcare, as we will see later.
At the same time, I knew that probably was never going to be the ultimate aim to just run digital programs within a hospital organization. So I did an exec MBA, Oxford, at the same time, which was, I think, again, one of those life moments that really does definitely open your mind, not so much the content of the MBA, but the people. Of course, this is what they say, it's the people, you know, suddenly having been in quite a echo chamber of healthcare, you know, like everyone that I knew was a doctor and everyone that I knew worked in a hospital. And suddenly then to be exposed to a bunch of people who are from across the world, from across industries, from across like perspectives of life. They haven't been on this very linear journey, which medicine is, right? You have to go through university, med school, training, practice. You know, suddenly you're people who are like coming in at much more significant life experiences from completely different directions. And so I think that was pretty important to open up my mind to what could be done in the world and then, you know, see if we could apply that to healthcare.
Okay, this is one of my favorite recurring themes across this series of podcasts and these series of stories. The importance of having the curiosity to seek, to learn from people outside your comfort zone. Cross-pollination of ideas is critical to the successful innovator. Nick so perfectly summarized that experience. Think about it. He has been the number one student at everything he has ever done and succeeded at everything he's ever tried. And yet, when he gets to business school, he learns very quickly how incredibly insular his entire experience had been. Now, how absurdly limited his thinking was by the constraints of his education, not his fault, of course, just the way we're brought up, so to speak, and educated. We will see this over and over again. Successful leaders are curious, and their curiosity inevitably leads them to seek advice, insight, counsel, ideas, and perspective from people and situations in adjacent fields to their own. Not necessarily completely disparate, but far enough away to provide perspective. Now, Nick knew some people who had won a hackathon for using AI in a very early version of natural language processing. And while he was still working in the hospital with whom he stayed in touch with these folks, and the team went on to start a company they called Euphonia with Nick as CEO and received small grants which allowed them to develop a proof of concept product and eventually land them from a small angel investor. But let's let Nick tell that story.
So the company's called Euphonia, and it originates from the insight that a huge amount of what I did and I think what most clinicians, whether they be doctors or any other type of clinician, is doing is having conversations with patients. And we're told at medical school, first day, taking the clinical history is 80% of what you're ever going to find out from the patient, examining them and doing investigations, just confirming what you found out by taking a clinical history. And I think that still remains true. And the vast, overwhelming amount of clinical care, you know, maybe bar like actual procedural specialties, is talking to patients. But yet, I thought that most of the conversations I had with patients were pretty stereotyped. I was basically having the same clinical consultation every week. That meant that I thought technology was also at a point that we could start to automate that. Now, this was before anyone had ever heard of a large language model, but we used a large language model or early versions of that back at the time. And so essentially what we do is we try to automate those clinical consultations that are repetitive and routine. We then free clinicians up to work at the top of their license because they don't have to have those consultations. We can do that in a much more scalable way. We can do it in a lower cost way. And really importantly, we do it in a much more convenient, reliable way for patients because we don't have to force patients to come and have an appointment when there's a space in someone's calendar or clinic diary. We can deliver that care when it suits the patient and when their clinical disease needs it. So it was actually supported by IBM back when they were trying to push forward their AI work. And so they had a bunch of AI API tooling. And so we basically were looking to see if we could use some of their tooling, their sort of core bits of natural language processing. So to do what we do, of course, it seems it's probably more obvious to people now than it was maybe 5 years ago when we started. But effectively what we're doing in real time is taking speech, turning it to text, understanding, choosing what to then say to the patient based on a kind of conversational model, and then turning that text back to speech. And we do that in the majority of cases down a telephone line. So there's kind of overlay of trying to do that with some of the limitations of audio bandwidth there to make it a much more accessible experience. Because we don't, you know, whilst we're a highly digital technology, we don't want the patients to have a digital experience. We want them to have a voice conversational experience, which is the same thing that they'd have with a doctor or a nurse. And I always used to say, the competitors is the incumbency. The competitors are humans, right? Because the competitor is, are doctors willing to allow this activity to be moved, to be done by automation rather than being done by themselves? And that still remains the case. I think there's, as you say, more and more acceptance of the ability of technology to do this as it creeps into people's day-to-day lives.
The competition in this conversation is the incumbency, and the incumbents are the humans. And this is seldom articulated as cogently, but Nick is absolutely right. Now, Clay Christensen, a famous economist from Harvard University, liked to ask the question, what are you hiring a specific product to do? And as importantly, who is doing that task for you now? Now, the second part of the equation is critical, because even if your product excels at a task, does the incumbent do it as well or at a lower cost? And if so, it's not likely you'll dislodge the incumbent. Now, technology in healthcare has to compete with humans. They are the incumbents, and humans are pretty good at some tasks. So the bar is high. Next, let's transition a bit to working with the NHS as an entrepreneur and how that went.
Actually, the NHS was and remains a really, I think, probably one of the best places to get off the ground with things, because it has although it's seen perhaps from the outside as a large centralized bureaucratic public sector, it actually is multiple sub-organizations. So in reality, there are 300 NHS trusts or thereabouts, all of them actually acting pretty much autonomously within a framework. And therefore, there's always somewhere that you can find who are willing to adopt and have a need. And I had a pretty deep relationship from all of the stuff that I'd done before in the NHS, in the kind of digital space in the NHS. So I think that gave me a unique advantage in the early days to find people who are willing to work with us and to get going. And then the sort of lack of commerciality of the NHS, it's now a real pain point for us at this stage we've got to now. But at the start, it's great because people are doing it not because they're ultimately having to prove like a return on investment at the early stage. They're doing it because they have a need, and therefore there's potentially a way to solve that need, and they have interest in getting some research, and therefore the permissiveness at that stage is actually quite good. And there's quite a lot of funding available in the UK for that early stage of product development and of innovation, if you know the right places to look. I think that is the weakness of the system here. So whilst I think it's really good for getting going, it's really poor for scaling. And so the only body that can or has some sort of remit to scale things from one of those organizations to multiple is essentially the centralized national, generally that's NHS England, which there's separate authorities for the other regions in the UK, but generally NHS England. And that body is not set up to be an innovation scaling service. Now, there are some initiatives within the NHS to try and help that. There's a brilliant initiative called the Clinical Entrepreneur Programme, which has found and supported and nurtured the human capital of people, but it relies on a personal network of people who are innovative and have innovative thoughts rather than any structural capacity to scale innovation. Lots of people trying. We're recipients of various sources of funding to try and do that, but the real challenge is actually not the money, it's the transformation. It's getting organizations to move, and particularly to move quickly. The killer is that organizational speed for adopting innovation is really low.
You'll hear this expressed in other interviews as well. No system seems to be perfect for innovating in healthcare. Now, what some see as a weakness of the NHS, Nick sees as a strength. And with the recent changes in government and the understanding that the NHS is indeed in crisis and in desperate need of innovation, I think we can expect things to finally change in the UK. As Winston Churchill once stated, never let a good crisis go to waste. Getting back to Nick, as he expands his footprint outside the UK, what has he learned about different markets?
Our system is commercially live in the UK. We have clinical trial running in Europe, in the Netherlands, and one that's just finished running but will continue in Canada. And then we have four or five academic medical centers in the US going live. And our first US employee started a month ago. And so I think the comparator is in the UK, particularly at the moment, the overriding narrative is capacity. So there's a capacity problem in healthcare. Now, actually, the reality is that's a problem everywhere in the world and will only get worse. But it's the UK are willing to see that there's a capacity problem. However, it has to be backed up by what are termed here cash releasing savings, because basically there's no money. So everyone wants more capacity. They want to reduce their demand supply mismatch, but they want to do that by releasing money, actual cash. So that's a kind of quite a challenging, and so I think one of the things that's also good about the UK is if you can prove it here, or you can prove it anywhere, because the barriers to adoption are, put in that are pretty high. So that's certainly the narrative. The headline narrative is capacity. And in the US, of course, the headline narrative is revenue generation. That's just the inverse of capacity, right? So I literally just change how I present this to say, rather than we can triple the number of patients that you can see to we can triple the amount of revenue that you can generate because we free up slots in your clinic because you don't have to see these patients. It's pretty straightforward. Now, all then have a kind of an overlay of things such as the patient acceptability and accessibility to patients and cost, of course. But yeah, it's really fundamentally, there is a supply-demand mismatch in healthcare, and we're trying to solve that because we're not going to solve it with humans ever going forwards. That boat has sailed, so we have to solve it with other technology in its broader sense, and ours is one version of the generative AI LEM space has really just profoundly moved forward the speed at which we can move the product. Now, the key thing about what we do is to do it, and for healthcare and for enterprise healthcare, is to do it in a safe, reliable, trusted way. So I would say the kind of key adoption challenge is getting clinicians broadly, but all of the people around the healthcare system to trust digital system to do a job that a clinician's been doing. That trust, it doesn't come easy. And it requires a significant amount of effort, which is what we put into to collect data, to publish, to attend conferences and present, and to work with partners to present that.
Nick framed this well. Again, when it comes to technology, the most important thing may not be how cool the technology is or how many features it has. The most important thing is whether or not it engenders trust in the user. I heard this theme elsewhere in my travels, talking to people in the robotics space. The core feature is always, or at least often, trust.
And also, though, the challenge of that is that we can't just flip the model that we're using. We can't just release a new feature without going through a process, whether that process is defined by regulators or, quite frankly, whether it's just the process that we define to be able to get credibility. So the ability to do things with newer, larger, more performant language models allows us to broaden the scope of what we're potentially able to do. It doesn't immediately turn into a change in the solution that clinicians and patients see. We have a development version of the system that uses some of the latest models in quite a complex multi-agent architecture. And that can, deliver in our experience, in the ratings we get from testers, better experience. But what we're having to do is to go through a process of getting that approved to release and getting the data to show that it's safe and trustworthy. I think one of the most interesting things that I heard now quite a few years ago was the founder of DeepMind, a company that's owned by Google now, when the AlphaGo system came out and beat world champion in Go. And there's a film made about it. And I was at a screening and he spoke at the start of that and said about their work that they were doing in healthcare, again, many years ago now, but said, up until now, society has prized doctors because they prize knowledge and they value knowledge. And doctors get paid more than nurses because we're paying for that knowledge. The knowledge is now not the valuable thing. The empathy, the interaction with patients is the thing that's valuable. And so going forwards, actually, the value of doctors should go down and the value of nurses should go up. And there should be a kind of crossing. At some point, I'm paraphrasing slightly what he said, but I still think that actually is the interesting thing. And so I think the model where you say, actually, look, nurses are doing the easier job, and therefore we'll use LLMs to replace this easier, lower complexity job, I think is almost the opposite of the truth. I think that that job actually becomes much, much harder. And in a job where basically you're just trying to pattern recognize a bunch of facts that a patient tells you to know whether that's significant or not, becomes the much easier and much more automatable job.
The idea that AI will take over the knowledge part of the equation and leave empathy as the last bastion of what it means to be human has been challenged of late by software trained to be empathic and at the same time infinitely patient. Now, people often repeat the worn phrase that AI will not replace doctors, but that doctors with the AI will replace doctors without. Now, this conversation raises a slightly different question. Will nurses with AI replace doctors with or without AI? Be that as it may, does euphonia work as expected?
We consistently see this two-thirds reduction in the need for human interactions. You know, translates to tripling the capacity of your clinic if deployed correctly. Absolutely. I think the really important thing about technology is you can do pretty much anything with technology, but particularly in an enterprise in a healthcare setting, you have to be willing to enact the change, the transformation to really see the benefits. So there's a version one benefit of deploy the technology. And I always approach the problem based on the kind of experience of trying to run some of these digital programs is if you ask people to deploy some digital solution and you ask them to change their process, and this is the general population of clinicians and hospital administrators, that's a really painful thing to do. You're asking them to do two painful things, and you're asking them to do them at once. It means it either doesn't happen, or it happens really slowly, or you just have to have a lot of, you have to over-index on stakeholder engagement. So we tried to start by saying, okay, look, you don't need to change your process. We're just going to be alike for what you're doing at the moment. I think what we see then pretty quickly is that's fine, but the real value comes is if you can change your process. And so I think how to...
This is a great point. To the extent that a new technology can embed itself in an existing workflow, the better the adoption rate. The problem comes into play when the workflow is broken to begin with, or when the workflow is optimized for humans and not machines. Now, for example, many analog processes are redundant to address human failability. Maybe two people do the same accounting to make sure there's no mistakes, but computers simply don't make addition errors. And this is partly why Nick states that the best results are obtained when tech adoption is coupled with an optimization of the workflow so as to take advantage of the skills of both humans and machines.
I think that the thing that most people question is, will patients want an automated AI system to talk to them rather than their doctor? The modal net promoter score we get, because we ask a net promoter score on every single call, within like 50,000 calls, is 10 out of 10. And that's because, for all the reasons that we say, it's more convenient, reliable for the patients. For the use cases that we're targeting to start with, which are straightforward ambulatory surgery, pre-op assessments and post-op follow-ups and outcome assessments, patients know that they're okay and they just need to be reassured that that's the case, or they want to make sure they can just communicate that information. Hear stories, and this is particularly from the US where the geography dictates it, of people who are having day case surgery, you know, driving more than 2 hours home to then drive back 2 hours like the next morning for a clinic appointment that lasts 10 minutes to then drive home again, to then come back a week later. This is not a good experience for anybody. It's not good economically for the country or for anyone who's paying for that person's time. Yeah, I think, you know, that's underlying why patients, we should be much more patient-centered in what we do.
All right, so this was an amazing conversation. And there are some great take-home points. One is to be true to yourself and adapt. Nicholas' journey is a powerful example of realizing when a seemingly ideal career path may not actually have been as fulfilling as one expected. And it's crucial to recognize when it's time to pivot, whether you're an individual or a company. Sometimes things once achieved are simply not what they're expected to do. They don't perform as well. And this conversation demonstrates how Nick pursued a more meaningful path for himself, and hundreds of thousands of patients will benefit. Cross-pollination of ideas, fueling innovation is probably my second take-home. Sort of breaking away from the echo chamber of healthcare, Nicholas's executive MBA experience exposed him to many, many diverse perspectives and underscored the value of learning from outside one's own field. So this openness to interdisciplinary insight is a critical trait, I think, shared by many, many successful innovators. Growth as a leader often comes through the curiosity that you have to seek advice and then listen. Another one is the idea that trust and technology adoption in healthcare are critical. So the trust piece. For healthcare technology to succeed, it must inspire trust. Euphonia was designed to integrate smoothly with existing workflows, recognizing that the best results come when adoption aligns with workflow, but especially if they're optimized. So the best results were obtained by systems willing to make some changes to their existing protocols. Yeah, I've definitely heard a lot of people say, this won't work unless it sits in our protocols. But yeah, are those really the best protocols you can think of when you're bringing both humans in the loop and machines in the loop? Probably not. So if you want to reach out to Nick and his team, here are some coordinates, and I will leave you with that.
So the URL is euphonia.com, euphonia.com. We're based here in Oxford. We have an office in London as well. And we also have an office out in the US in Houston, because we were part of the Texas Medical Center Accelerator Program last year. So we're basing our activities out of the Southern US at the moment. Yeah, through the website, but equally you can just send me an email at ndep@euphonia.com.
Hey there, this is Stefano again, and I'm excited to share this new podcast. I traveled the world on my sabbatical, and I was meeting healthcare innovators with incredible stories, and I just want to share them. So let's connect. I want to hear your thoughts. DM me on LinkedIn, and I'll reply to every message. And if you like these conversations as much as I did, share the podcast. Give it a like. Your support will help spread these inspiring stories to even more people. Thank you.